Our second case this morning is 2021-1518, Disciplinary Counsel versus the Honorable Pinky Susan Carr. You will notice that we have two judges who are sitting on the panel today. For Judge Donnelly, we have Judge Myers from the First District Court of Appeals. Welcome, Judge.
Thank you.
And we have Judge Lisa Sadler from the 10th District Court of Appeals sitting for Justice Stewart. Both Justice Donnelly and Justice Stewart have recused in this matter. We'll start with the respondent, Mr. Froning.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. My name is Nicholas Froning, and I have the honor and privilege of representing the respondent, Judge Pinky Carr, in this matter. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of time for my rebuttal. I'd like to bring to this court's attention 3 points. The first, this matter should be remanded to the board for two reasons: a correct application of the contribution standard called for under GovBar Rule 13C7, and second, for a complete analysis of GovBar Rule 13C7. The second point I'd like to make before this honorable court is that in its de novo review, if it does not remand the matter to the board, this court should grant the respondent the full mitigative credit of GovBar Rule 13C7 based upon the record, the expert reports, the testimony of the expert, and the credibility afforded to him by the board. Finally, after this court looks at the stipulated misconduct, the stipulated aggravation and mitigation in this case, an appropriate resolve would be a 24-month suspension with 18-month stayed with the conditions outlined before this court. The first matter is the fact that in the panel hearing, the standard applied what was a causation standard when a contribution standard is required.
How are they different?
Well, causation defined is and it expresses or implies a cause. It's a cause and effect relationship. Whereas a contribute is defined as tending to bring a result.
But isn't contribution sort of a subset of causation?
Sure. As the definition elicits, it tends to bring about a cause. There could be numerous contributing factors to a cause, and so it's not absolute. And what's important in that aspect or in this idea is that if this court, in drafting the GovBar rules, wanted either or, the rule would read a determination that the disorders contributed to or caused the misconduct. And that's not how it's written. It's written the determination that the disorders contributed to cause the misconduct. And so in the panel report, in its 58-page report, the panel discusses attribute, discusses a causal link, but does not utilize the word contribution in its analysis.
So one more follow-up. So you're saying contribution could be the genesis of a cause, but not part of the cause?
Well, no, I'm not saying that, Your Honor. What I'm saying is there could be multiple contributing factors to a cause. And so the disorder is a factor that contributed to cause the misconduct. And I think it's important in the panel. The panel chair had a discussion with the relator in his closing arguments, and about the application of GovBar Rule 13C7. And the panel chair says, in regards to 13C7, that the rule, in my mind, reads as black and white. And we agree. We agree that the rule should be read as contribute to cause the misconduct. It's not attribute, it's not causal link, it's not causal relationship. The fact is it's a contributing factor to cause the misconduct. In the answer before this honorable court by the relator, there's an argument.
Well, counsel, are you saying that but for condition or whatever is deemed to be Judge Carr's, problems, but for that, none of this would have happened? Is that what you're saying?
No, Your Honor. But for would mean that it's a cause. It's a contributing factor. The expert in this case routinely, throughout the entire testimony, opined that the disorders contributed to cause the misconduct. I don't think there is a. I don't think we can find an actual causation of why somebody does something.
How did this contribution cause five people to spend 28 days in jail?
Well, as the expert testified, Judge Carr suffered from mistreated or untreated sleep apnea, menopause, and then a generalized mood disorder. And the issue here is that her treaters were essentially mistreating the conditions, causing there to be counteracting issues. So when it comes to sleep apnea, she was unable to get the sleep necessary. When it comes to the menopause, she was dealing with issues wherein she wasn't able to function to 100%. And once those issues were identified, I think it's important, it's getting to my second point, but the board and the panel and the relator in this case have brought up the case of disciplinary counsel versus O'Neill. And we believe that O'Neill applies on all four corners. And what this honorable court did in O'Neill that I think was the most important in seeking an explanation for the behavior was ask the question, why? Why? Why did this behavior occur? How did this behavior occur? That question's been answered in this matter.
How does sleep apnea or menopause contribute to lying?
Well, it affects her mood. It affects her ability to think clearly. It affected numerous areas of her life. The fact is this: everyone reacts differently. Everyone reacts differently. One of the arguments of the panel and the board is that thousands of lawyers have suffered from sleep apnea and or menopause and not engaged in misconduct. I would agree with that. The issue is that everyone reacts differently. If we think about...
But if she was being treated, let me read you the first sentence of paragraph 153 of the report. She was already being treated at this point. It says, respondent misled her lawyer, her character witnesses, and her therapist to make her misconduct appear less serious than it was. Considered with respondent's lies to Judge Early and the media, and hence the public, about not issuing KPSs and her falsification of journal entries, these lies to her own lawyer and therapist demonstrate a disturbing dishonesty that pervades response behavior in this case. Connect, please, the sleep apnea or menopause to those actions.
Well, yes, Your Honor, and it's the expert in this matter opined, again, that those disorders contributed to cause of misconduct. The rule calls for a qualified healthcare professional to make these opinions, and this expert was given great credibility by the panel and board. Now, he opined that the sleep apnea, hypopnea moderate, the menopause, along with the generalized anxiety disorder, contributed to cause the misconduct.
Counsel, is this the treatment provider who didn't read the record, who admitted to only glancing at the reports and the 7 hours of video?
Yes, Your Honor. So this individual, first, it was his first time testifying, when he responded to the amount of video that he watched, I believe it's in the record, it says somewhere between 15 and 30 minutes. But when questioned further on that, he said it might have been longer. If you look at the
okay, it might have been longer.
Correct, Your Honor.
31 minutes?
45 minutes, an hour. He just didn't know the exact amount of time that he had watched. The question then becomes, how much time is necessary to make these opinions? These opinions.
But was he the best one to make the opinion? He was also her personal psychotherapist, and then he was also serving as an objective forensic scientist. How could he do both?
Well, chronologically, he was retained as the forensic psychological evaluator. There was no previous relationship with the respondent. It wasn't until the time that his recommendations came about and the fact that time was running before the hearing, the only option she had at that point, based upon the pandemic and likewise, was to immediately start treating. She has since got a different treater that she's engaging in the weekly sessions with. And so it was a matter of necessity and convenience. I would like to go back to your question. When we talk about everybody reacts differently, I think it's important that we look back over the pandemic and we think about those individuals in our lives who are affected by COVID-19. Some people were, there was no effects. Some lost their taste, some lost their smell. Some were hospitalized, some had permanent damage, and some unfortunately died. I think the point there is that we all react differently to viruses, to mental health issues, to medical conditions, and that's why we rely on experts in this matter. The expert opined throughout the disorders contributed to cause the misconduct. The relator in his answer before this honorable court would have you believe that we can take the definition of cause or contribution, interchange it into the rule, and that the standard will not be altered. Such an act would make those words meaningless. The rule is written and should be construed because, as lawyers, words matter. Words matter in a contract. They matter in a rule. They matter in an ordinance, and they should be applied appropriately. If there's no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you. Ms. Caligiuri?
May it please the court, Chief Justice O'Connor, distinguished members of this court, visiting judges, I'm Joe Caligiuri and I represent the Office of Disciplinary Counsel. I would like to address a few points that my opposing counsel made. First of all, opposing counsel stated that the board gave Dr. Reby great credibility. The reality of it is that while the board treated Dr. Reby with the respect that he deserved, they completely eviscerated his credibility based upon several factors. Number one, as this court has already stated, he was conflicted in his testimony and in the dual roles that he undertook in this case. He started out as an objective forensic psychologist who was there to give objective advice and testimony, and within a month of authoring his report, he transitioned to her treating clinician, in which he was obligated to do his client no harm. And as the chief brought up, he testified that he viewed 15 to 30 minutes of video in arriving at his conclusions. Relator provided him well in advance of 7 hours and 38 minutes of video, and there was simply no reason for him not to have viewed the entirety of those videos. And as the board noted, you simply cannot get the flavor of the volume and depth of this misconduct without viewing the video. Even that's stated directly in their report, which was 58 pages long. So that gives you an idea of the depth of the misconduct here. And then, as Justice Fisher pointed out, Dr. Reby himself admitted that he could not make a connection between his diagnoses and the lying. That was his own testimony on page 175 of the transcript. And so because there was a pervasive pattern of dishonesty in this case, the board found that his opinions were of limited utility in this particular case. He also opined on only certain aspects of the misconduct. He didn't address some of the most serious issues that arose in this case. In fact, during the testimony, he had no idea what the issues involving Count 5 and the 20-year-old woman, A.B., who was held in contempt of court and thrown in jail for 15 days. He had no knowledge of that incident. And he admitted to the panel that he didn't have time because of his other duties in his private practice to review all of the materials to that level, to that level of depth. And so, again, this is really a credibility determination regarding Dr. Reby, and the board went through a painstaking analysis in its 58-page report to explain to this court why it was that his analysis was so fraught and was so fragile and just simply not sound. And there's no evidence in the record that weighs heavily against the panel's credibility determinations, and therefore, as this court has held, even in the case that the respondent cited, the Funstein case, we're not going to disturb a panel's credibility determinations unless the record weighs heavily against it. So Dr. Reby's testimony simply did not meet the moment in this case, and it's absolutely obvious. Number two, my opposing counsel brought up this standard that was applied, the causation or contribution standard. And he says, well, if you can't just mix these words together, causation and contribution. But that overlooks an obvious fact, and that is that the rule itself contains both of those words. It's contribute to cause the misconduct. And that's exactly the standard that the board applied in evaluating Dr. Reby's diagnosis and the misconduct. And of course, again, even if you were to accept that argument, Dr. Reby himself admitted that there was no contribution or causation or however you want to describe it with regard to the lying. And the lying was such a huge portion of this case, so it cannot be overlooked. So it doesn't matter whether the board referred to it as a contribution to or a causal link. I've cited several cases, Jolton, Rumazin, in my brief, in which this court has used those terms interchangeably, causation and contribution. So again, there's no issue there. With regard to a request for remand, there is absolutely no reason to remand this case. First of all, even if this court were to entertain respondents' argument, the record is completely developed. There's no reason to send it back. The respondent presented her complete picture of mitigation to the board. So if this court wanted to adopt this argument in its de novo review, you can simply apply the facts that have already been developed in the record. Of course, I would suggest that there's no reason to accept respondents' argument, but there's definitely no reason for a remand.
Counsel?
Yes.
On paragraph 199, report and recommendation says, but for cooperation, another factor, the recommendation would be indefinite suspension, correct?
Yes.
Let me ask you something. On paragraph 152, talking about some of the character letters, this is what was written by the board. This was not true and mirrored the false assertions in her answer to the first amended complaint.
Yes.
How is that cooperation?
Well, the cooperation in this matter, Your Honor, was late. There's no doubt about it. Up until that point, really from maybe a couple months after the respondent submitted her answer to the amended complaint, did she actually come around and accept responsibility for her misconduct and really turn the tables on her cooperation. Up until that point in time, she was still exhibiting very troubling patterns of dishonesty, as I think you mentioned before when you read from the opinion during my opposing counsel's argument. You know, she had lied not only to her therapist, but also to her lawyer and to the character witnesses as well. But at the end of the day, she did cooperate in the sense that she entered into complete stipulations during her examination. She admitted to all the factual allegations and all of the 25 different rule violations and did seem to express genuine remorse. So the board gave her credit for a cooperative attitude, but there's no question about it that it was late in coming.
Well, if this court takes away a license for a magistrate, I think it's in the Bachman case, for 6 months for one incident, Is 2 years term suspension really proper in this case?
It's a fair question, Your Honor. That sanction was a function of our case law. We have Bachman and we have Rep.
Rep
was a one-year suspension for an isolated incident of misconduct. Bachman was a 6-month suspension for an isolated incident of misconduct. And here, the misconduct's the volume is in a different stratosphere.
And for years.
And for a minimum of 2 years. But we also look at some of the cases decided 14, 15 years ago, and even O'Neill back in 2010, where we ended up with essentially a one-year suspension of actual time off in those cases. And so when you look at the volume of misconduct, we feel that given the fact that she is addressing her mental health issues, and she ultimately did stipulate and come around on the misconduct here, that 2 years would be a sufficient sanction that would not only recognize her misconduct, but also just deter other members of our judiciary from engaging in a similar type of misconduct. But there's no question that the recommendation between 2 years and indefinite was very thin. I mean, the line differentiating the two was very thin. Relator and the board felt that based upon her cooperation towards the end of this case, that it warranted a 2-year suspension.
Counsel, if she is, if we agree and she is then served with a 2-year suspension plus the conditions, et cetera,
yes,
for reinstatement, there's still going to be collateral consequences for her in her role as an elected official, is there not?
Yes, there will be collateral consequences in the sense that she is up for re-election in 2023. And so a 2-year suspension would preclude her from running for judge again in that election cycle.
Okay, so 2 years here is more, really more than 2 years with regard to her current position.
Yes, for her ability to sit as a judge, that's correct. Unless there are any further questions, I'll yield the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, you have about 3.5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just as to a couple points brought by my opponent, when you look at the transcript and you look at the record and the expert opining relative to the line or dishonest conduct, I think when you look at the transcript, relator and was questioning the expert as to a causal connection. Again, words matter. We have to utilize the correct phrasing, contribute to cause. And so I think we are a nation of laws and not men and women. And so regardless of the conduct engaged in by the respondent in this matter, it is important that we apply the language of the rules as written. There is no question that the conduct engaged in by Judge Pinky Carr was egregious, and it lasted for a period of approximately 2 years. She's admitted that. She's stipulated to that. She has taken full responsibility for her conduct, albeit after the filing of an answer in the amended complaint, but that shows the growth that she is engaged in after receiving the appropriate treatment and recommendations. As to the sanction, it's important to distinguish between Bachman and Rep and Medley and Parker. Only one of those involved mental health mitigation, and that was Parker. And in that case, the expert that they had retained in that matter did not opine relative to a sustained course of treatment and or the ability to currently, competently, and ethically engage in the practice of law. And so Parker wasn't able to have the full mitigative credit because the expert didn't opine to that. In regards to all four cases, each one of them in this honorable court's decision, we cite that the respondents in those matters didn't acknowledge the wrongfulness of their conduct. Taking responsibility is a very important aspect in our disciplinary process. And as aggravation, it can be detrimental and it can increase the sanction. Here, there was a fully stipulated matter. It was a sanctioned case, for all intents and purposes, admitted to by the panel. And so I think when we look at these cases, we have to acknowledge the vast mitigation afforded to the respondent, both by stipulation, accepted by the panel, and adopted by the board. And we have to look at their analysis. I think it's very important that this court has utilized terms such as causal link, causal relationship, and just because it has, it doesn't mean that it was the right application. I think we have to look at utilizing contribute to cause and use those words as written. And so for that matter, we would ask that this be remanded to the board for further review of GovBar Rule 13C7. If not, this court in its de novo review should apply full mitigative credit under 13C7. And finally, a 24-month suspension with 18 months stayed and the conditions cited is the appropriate resolve. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, we call a recess, please.
All rise.